Welcome to the weekend. I'm Angela Cocheriga. U.S. Customs and Border Protection Acting Commissioner Mark Morgan visited El Paso this week, and I had the opportunity for a one-on-one interview with him. We covered a wide range of issues, including the federal government's border wall, the controversial private barrier in Sunland Park, migrant children in hotels, and new measures to discourage U.S. citizens and legal permanent residents from going back and forth across the border during the shutdown, unless there's a truly essential reason. We stood near a section of border wall in East El Paso, and both wore masks. Commissioner Morgan began by talking about the features of what he calls a wall system.
It's got these flat, what we call anti-climb plates that are on top to make it even harder to climb over. Stuff that's never existed before. You can see it's got integrated lighting. There's going to be technology that I don't want to talk too much about. But then what's very important too, access roads. So when I say that, all of that goes together to form the wall system. That's never like anything else that we've built before. And so I'll say right now, we've got over 300 miles of wall system been completed, and we're gonna have 450 miles done by the end of this year. And you know what, there's a lot of naysayers that thought we weren't gonna get anywhere close to that. So it's been an incredible achievement.
It's a little confusing. Wall system could be a very important upgrade that you're talking about here, but it's not like this was wide open no man's land. There was an existing barrier. So how much of new barrier has been
built? 300 miles of new barrier. 300 miles of new wall system has been built. That's my answer.
In replacing other wall.
300 miles of brand new wall system. That's my answer, and that's going to continue to be my answer because it's true.
Okay, so even if it's going in the place of something that was already here.
Look, here I'll give you another analogy, right? So if you have a 25-year-old car and you go the weekend and you buy a brand new, pick a car, Mercedes, right? And somebody asks you, what'd you do this weekend? I guarantee you no one says I bought a replacement vehicle. They said, hey, I bought a brand new car. Why? Because it's brand new in every single way. And that's why I look at this brand new wall system.
We saw some high-level DHS employees, including our local Border Patrol Chief Chavez, also there at a public event, touting and praising that private wall. That was later used as a fundraising tool by the We Build the Wall people. What would you want to say about that? Because now that some of those very people have faced indictment for fraud and for money laundering.
Yeah, so we had nothing to do with that. So it was a private entity, a private endeavor that CBP had absolutely nothing to do with. Hey, if somebody wants to take on a private endeavor and help secure the border, you know, we're not going to, you know, weigh in on that. And if somebody does want to do something that helps secure the border, again, we're not going to go against that. But we had nothing to do with We Build the Wall whatsoever.
Well, you did, your people did praise it and had a public event, and it was used as in effect, people were told they endorsed it. And then what would you say to those people who contributed, fully believing that there was some confusion there, that DHS supported that wall and supported that fundraising effort?
Like I said, we support any private citizen doing anything within the law that would help secure the border and protect the Americans. So that's where the support was coming from. But we never officially supported them in any capacity. So there was it was a completely separate entity, a completely separate initiative that CBP had nothing to do with.
And just to be clear, El Paso Border Patrol Chief Norma Chavez and DHS Acting Secretary Chad Wolf praised the private border wall at a press conference in response to questions. They did not attend a separate public event organized by the We Build the Wall group. You know, I've covered this agency a long time. You can probably tell I'm a seasoned reporter. And so, you know, the DHS and the legacy agencies, and there was always an attempt by leadership to go out of their way to not to allow it to be politicized, to talk about operations, but not policy, even as Congress or presidents tried to draw them in. We've seen a real shift, and, you know, these trips are coming as, you know, during the RNC convention. Of course, it's a signature promise of President Trump, but what would you say to critics who say this should not be politicized? This is a security agency, and it raises concerns for the American public that, you know, this might be used as a photo op during a re-election campaign.
Hey, look, you know, how a political party uses what we do, that's out of my control. What I can tell you, though, as the acting commissioner of CBP, I am here officially. I am here to, it's not a celebratory issue. To me, it's actually about recognizing a tremendous achievement, right? So like the border wall, for example, this is a significant, it's a tremendous achievement. It's a tremendous achievement that we've given a tool to the Border Patrol agents to more effectively do their job to protect this country, while at the same time allowing them to do their job more effectively. So as the acting commissioner, I'm proud to be here. I'm proud to be here to recognize this achievement. Now, you know, how somebody uses that politically, that's out of our control. And I can tell you, it cuts both ways, because politics, there have been, politics used on one side to say it's great, and there's been political events to say how horrible it is. So both sides have politicized this.
I asked about the care of migrant children and Title 42 expulsions. That policy allows for the rapid removal of migrants, including children seeking asylum, as part of COVID-19 restrictions at the border.
And now we have children held in hotel rooms kind of secretly. People are finding out about this after the fact. What would you want to say? Why is it secret? And what about the care of those migrant children?
So I'd probably object strenuously to your premise that it's secretly, like there's some nefarious thing that's going, when it's actually completely the opposite. So let me address that a little bit. So because exactly what's happening, right? So when advocacy groups found out that hotel chains were actually allowing ICE to use the facilities, guess what happened? They went out and they protested, and they drove those hotels to then not work with ICE anymore. So there is a level of you know, operational sensitivities that we want to do, but that doesn't mean anything's being done in secret. And I'll tell you, actually, by moving the children, so instead of the children being in congregate settings of Border Patrol, which are these open air environments, which is could be conducive to the further spread of COVID, is that we're actually then giving them to ICE, who actually is really a quasi isolation concept. Right? So they're not further exposed. They're not in these settings exposed to hundreds of other individuals. So it was actually for their protection that they did that going forward. And it's been very effective.
But it's a private contractor caring for the children who normally handles transportation. So are they getting the proper child care? And some parents have said they didn't even, or relatives didn't even know where these children were.
So look, you'll have to ask ICE specifically, because that's our bailiwick on those specific questions.
Okay.
But again, that's right. My understanding from CBP, of which in those instances, we give those individuals, we transfer the ICE, and then they take it from there, like you described, in these hotel settings until they're processed and we remove them.
Okay, fair enough. We'll ask ICE.
Sure.
One of the things Acting CBP Commissioner Mark Morgan wanted to highlight during his visit to El Paso was the border shutdown to all but essential travel. New measures are now in place to discourage U.S. citizens and legal permanent residents from going back and forth across the border unless there's an essential reason. You'll hear him refer to legal permanent residents as LPRs at POEs, which are ports of entry.
Now let's go to the travel restrictions, non-essential travelers. I think most people heard of the POEs. What we saw is when we instituted that and we said, hey, look, if you're traveling for essential reasons, you can come in. Non-essential, no, you can't come in. The irony here is the Mexican nationals, they heeded the medical advice. They stopped. And right after we instituted that, we saw a precipitous drop in cross-border traffic by 50%. But the irony here is, guess who kept coming? U.S. CITs and LPRs. So, of course, the travel restrictions did not apply to U.S. citizens. We're not going to bar a U.S. citizen from coming in. But what we saw is, we did a survey, 83% of the individuals going back and forth to Mexico in the United States, right now, as we're seeing a spike along the southwest border, 83% were U.S. CITs and LPRs. We did a survey of 106,000 U.S. CITs and LPRs over a five-day period, and we found of those 83%, 63% of U.S. citizens and LPRs were traveling for non-essential reasons, back and forth.
So how will you, because you're right, the enforcement was happening in Mexican nationals, but not actual U.S. citizens.
Correct.
Are legal. So what can you do?
So what we've now done is we've shifted a little bit, and we're really adjusting our resources to focus on the non-essential travelers, right? And so I'm less concerned about those that are traveling for non-essential reasons. Like, for example, in Laredo, we set up a essential and non-essential lane. And so you're U.S. citizen. Again, you can still come, but you're going to go to this non-essential lane, and maybe it's going to be one lane. And I'm not really worried about having that man 24 hours, right? We're going to reduce the hours. I'm going to take all the resources to help the essential travelers come in. So we're trying additional measures to help address that.
What would be your message to people who were just kind of going back and forth? There are some essential reasons, but clearly not everyone was doing something essential.
Correct. That's spot on. And I wish more people would ask that question. So thank you. The answer is pretty clear. The answer to people that are going back and forth the U.S.-Mexican border is the same message to U.S. citizens that in this country have sacrificed so much, right? They've stayed at home. You know, they're having to, work from home, sometimes not working to take care of their kid now that can't go to school now, it's going virtually. So the citizens that are living in this country are sacrificing so much. We're asking the same thing for individuals that are going back and forth. Heed the warning of the medical experts. Stay. Quarantine yourself. Do not go back and forth if you don't have to. You are contributing to the spread of COVID-19. And you're not going to have to do it forever. But right now on the southwest border, we're seeing a spike all the way across. But yet we still have people coming back and forth to go to their favorite restaurant that's open or attend a family gathering. They need to stop.
Thank you, Mr. Morgan.
Yep, you bet.
Appreciate
Thank you.
It.
Now for an update on the race for a COVID-19 vaccine. Phase 3 trials on humans are taking place across the country, but there are concerns about who is included in these trials and their impact on communities. To learn more, Texas Public Radio's Maria Mendez takes us to 2 trial sites along the South Texas border.
That's a TV playing in the background of what at first glance looks like a typical lobby in a typical medical clinic. Workers and scrubs come and go, with things like a vitals cart. Flyers tacked onto the walls remind people to wear a mask and maintain a distance. Another flyer on glossy white paper with blue and green lettering is for a new medical trial, a potential COVID-19 vaccine. I'm here in McAllen to talk with Shruti Konda, Chief Operations Officer for Centex Studies, a clinical research company. Right in this place, Centex is conducting vaccine trials for Moderna. That's a U.S. pharmaceutical company racing for a COVID-19 vaccine.
And he is the one that prepares the drug. He's called an unblinded pharmacist. So he's the only one that knows whether a patient's getting placebo or the vaccine.
So Moderna sends them vaccine doses, and they're testing them on volunteers from McAllen. Konda says they've been doing drug trials in McAllen since 2017. But this is their first vaccine trial.
We heard from the pharma companies that were looking for sites, and our business development team reached out to them, and we did a qualification visit.
And Moderna picked roughly 89 trial sites across the country. But the site in McAllen has a very special participant pool. The border city is 85% Latino.
When you look at Hispanics, traditionally we have high prevalence with hypertension, diabetes, heart problems, and we wanted to just make sure that Hispanics and other minorities were being taken in consideration as they did this trial.
Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar asked for Texas's hard-hit border communities to be included in the trials, but not all border residents have been as enthusiastic. I spoke with Alberto Castilleja. He's 23 and a finance student in Dallas, but he has family in Laredo, so when the pandemic hit, he moved back in.
You know, I've been keeping up with the news since, I would say, April. I've been aware of the, 17-plus vaccine trials that are happening right now.
When he found out there would be trials for a COVID vaccine in Laredo, he decided to look into it.
They were just looking for people who work at exposed environments or are at high risk. And there was, a checklist of 4 criteria to be met in order to participate, but the process didn't take more than 2 minutes long.
Castilleja wants to participate, but he's concerned that the trials may take advantage of a vulnerable community, a 95% Latino city with high uninsured and poverty rates.
So there's always that distrust, especially when there's cases like the 1976, swine flu vaccination program that a lot of individuals got sick due to. So there's always certain things that the government or medical institutions have done that target people of color. in ways that impact us negatively.
Medicine and clinical research have changed since those historical incidents. There's a rigorous, regulated process for research.
We're answerable to regulatory bodies and we take it very seriously.
That's Shruti Konda. She's the Chief Operations Officer for Centex Studies. She's at the clinical site in McAllen.
And we have the Ethics Board, which is the Institutional Review Board. They're responsible for patient safety and making sure the patient's rights are not violated in any way. And then there's FDA that regulates all of this.
After Konda screens patients over the phone, if they qualify, the physician assistant, Wesley Keaton, screens them in person.
So when they get to phase three trials, those are basically the trials to see if the drug works and how long does it work for. So that means they already know it's safe. They've already used it on humans in smaller groups, and they know that there's hardly any side effects or very mild side effects. So.
And once a person is enrolled in the study, they're closely monitored for any potential side effects.
So that's our observation room, and this is where the patients get vaccinated for the COVID trials, and we observe them for like 30 minutes.
They've enrolled more than 200 patients, and according to Centex, nobody has had any severe adverse reaction so far. But Alberto Castilleja says he's been worried about another issue with access, health insurance. As a DACA recipient, he says he didn't have insurance until landing an internship this summer with a brokerage firm that focuses on health insurance.
I got a sense of what the insurance industry looked like. I've never been insured, which is funny, but I finally got to understand how complex it is.
He's not alone. In Laredo, 29.1% of the population is uninsured, and in McAllen, it's 26.8%, according to census data from 2018. Health insurance is key because without it, the vaccine could be quite expensive. And at a congressional hearing in July, Moderna said it planned to profit off the vaccine, which has already received federal funding.
We provided to them almost $2 billion.
That's Congressman Henry Cuellar. So Moderna got taxpayer funding and will charge taxpayers a second time when the vaccine becomes available. That could mean that taxpayers here in border communities that are helping test this new vaccine could potentially not have access because of the high price, estimated at $60 for the two doses needed.
There is a law that says that all Americans will have access. So if somebody doesn't have insurance, there would not be a hurdle to get a vaccine.
Congress has continued to work with Moderna, so if its vaccine is successful, the federal government may have to pick up the tab for those who can't afford it. But Moderna isn't the only company working on a vaccine. Centex in McAllen is starting vaccine trials with another company, AstraZeneca, soon. AstraZeneca did promise to price their vaccine at no profit. Moderna did not respond to our request for comment, but its CEO has said it will work out lower pricing for large orders and will be, quote, responsible on price. Still, its vaccine is reported as the most expensive one from all the contenders. Back in Laredo, Castilleja finally got a response after weeks of waiting. He went in for a screening.
All the questions I had in mind and concerns were addressed by the medical staff.
Staff also warned him he could develop side effects like fatigue, a rash, or even a fever. And after weighing all the information, Castilleja decided to enroll in the study.
This has the potential to make things go back to a new normal, reduce deaths if it's effective. And lastly, it was very comforting knowing that there was other people from Laredo signing up to this trial the day I got there to the clinic.
He'll have to go back for a booster shot in September. Meanwhile, officials in the border county of Starr have announced they are working on launching a vaccine trial there to recruit more Latino participants. I'm Maria Mendez in Laredo.
In July, a federal coronavirus eviction moratorium expired. It did not cover every rental unit, didn't even cover most, but it prevented some landlords from evicting tenants as the economy collapsed. KRA's Christopher Connolly explains why housing experts are warning a wave of evictions is imminent.
Stuart Campbell thinks this fall could get bad, like really bad. He's a housing attorney for Legal Aid of Northwest Texas.
I think we don't have any idea what's going to happen, and that's scary.
From the end of March to the end of July, Campbell says a combination of the eviction moratorium plus a federal housing boost to unemployment checks and stimulus money kept many of the most vulnerable people from being evicted when they fell behind on rent because they lost work or got sick. What the moratorium didn't do
it didn't itself forgive a tenant's contractual obligation to pay a rent. They still owe that rent.
By late July, more than a quarter of Americans had already missed a rent or mortgage payment, and a third of renters weren't sure that they could pay in August. Landlords in CARES Act-protected properties were free to start the eviction process. And that started a 30-day countdown, which ended this week.
The CARES Act was the dam, and instead of Congress adding to it or keeping it up, they've decided to knock it down, and so that wave is coming.
The National Low Income Housing Coalition estimates that 30 to 40 million people in the U.S. are vulnerable to eviction this year. To put that in context, during the whole of the Great Recession, about 10 million people were foreclosed upon or evicted.
We're on the precipice of a housing crisis of really epic proportions that rivals really the Great Depression. And that's on top of, right, what is a public health crisis?
Lisa Alexander is a professor at Texas A&M School of Law who studies federal housing policy. She says new federal protections for renters are stuck in limbo as Congress and the White House remain at loggerheads over the next round of coronavirus relief. Democrats want more help for renters, Republicans not as much. And while the president has publicly supported extending the ban on residential evictions, the executive order he signed didn't actually do that.
Therefore, many people, if they're not living in a state or a county or a city that has enacted some kind of protection, they can be evicted now.
That describes most people in Texas, where a shortage of affordable housing meant nearly half of all renters were already paying more than they could afford before the pandemic hit. And Alexander says a history of racist housing policies have rendered people of color particularly vulnerable to eviction.
What has happened is that COVID-19 has just exacerbated the problems that existed before.
Landlords say extending an eviction moratorium just passes the burden of America's affordable housing shortage onto them. Ian Mattingly runs LumaCorps, which operates 6,000 rental units in Texas. He says rental housing is a $1 trillion-a-year industry.
Even if it's only 15 or 20% of your residents who are not paying rent, I dare you to name an industry in the world that can take a 20% reduction in income and not have effects throughout the entirety of the economy.
Mattingly also heads the Apartment Association of Greater Dallas, and he's optimistic Congress will send more help. Meanwhile, he says landlords are working with people as much as they can.
I've seen members doing things that 6 or 9 months ago would probably have been unthinkable as far as payment reductions, deferrals, waiving late fees, and deferring evictions.
With all the talk of millions of looming evictions, legal aid lawyer Stuart Campbell says it's easy to lose sight of what evictions do to individual families.
It's a very traumatic experience when a man with a gun and a badge shows up after putting a red placard on your door and says, either you leave or I put you in cuffs and forcibly remove you from your home. And by the way, the landlord's here with a couple movers to put all your stuff on the curb.
As things stand right now, that's a trauma that one out of every 10 Texans could experience in the next few months. I'm Christopher Connolly in Dallas.
The EP Rent Help Program can help local landlords with rental assistance to prevent evictions. The Paso del Norte Community Foundation and its partners have disbursed more than $1.3 million. The foundation encourages landlords to ensure their eligibility for future rental assistance funding by visiting eprenthelp.org to complete the eligibility verification process. And finally, smuggling persists during the pandemic. CBP officers continue to seize loads of drugs at ports of entry. The contraband in the El Paso area also includes a popular food item, Mexican bologna. There's a craving for bologna from Mexico on both sides of the border. Customers at the La Mejor Texas Meat Shop in El Paso come for
calidad, producto fresco.
Quality, freshness, and good prices, says market manager Raul Burrell. The classic ranchera music, cuts of beef, and house marinades also provide a taste of Mexico.
Bueno, deme una y media y una y media de chavo.
Medium Ortiz is picking up some steaks and short ribs. But there's one thing this loyal customer cannot buy here or any other store in the U.S., Mexican bologna. The best known brand is Chimex.
I love that. I love Chimex, you know, like, but they don't sell it over here, and it's very frustrating because we can't cross it either.
The bologna is not allowed across the border because it's made with pork and could introduce a foreign animal disease into the U.S. But that does not stop people from trying to slip it into the country. Catherine Vasquez is a U.S. Customs and Border Protection agriculture specialist in El Paso.
It's loved and they crave it. They smuggle it across because they're able to sell it, per se, under the table.
In the more than 20 years Vasquez has inspected products at border crossings, Mexican bologna persists as one of the most popular prohibited food items. The contraband comfort food in the form of red-colored rolls turns up time and time again.
They call them chubs, those round rolls.
The chubs weigh about 10 pounds each. While some are for personal consumption, larger quantities carefully concealed in cars and trucks are smuggled for profit. The price of a roll at least doubles once it crosses the border, according to Vasquez.
Say anywhere from $30 to $40 all the way up to further north, up to $80 for one single roll.
Mexican bologna has turned up across Texas and the rest of the country. Some of those trying to sneak the sausages across the border these days are people who've lost their jobs during the pandemic, says Vasquez.
People who normally wouldn't do it are engaging in this type of smuggling activity.
Since May, CPB officers at border crossings in El Paso have seized at least 1,000 pounds of bologna. One man had 35 rolls hidden under blankets in the back seat of his SUV. He also had 9 rolls of another illegal lunch meat. Though the border is closed to essential travel, U.S. citizens can cross back and forth. The penalty for not declaring a commercial amount is a $1,000 fine.
Have you tasted this bologna yourself? Have you ever tried it?
No. I know that it takes forever to burn.
CPB officers destroy the bologna by incinerating it at ports of entry. And yes, it does smell like a big hot dog roast. Back at the La Mejor Texas meat shop, the manager points out the store has some great bologna in the deli section. But for customer Medium Ortiz, who grew up eating the Chimex brand in Mexico, it's just not the same.
It doesn't have the same flavor. I don't know if it's because it's Americanized. I don't know if it has the same ingredients. And over there, it's kind of like a reddish color. So I really don't know what's in there, but it's really good. So, yeah.
Even so, at this meat market, customers say there are plenty of other choices for those who crave the flavor of Mexico. Lauren Gore recently moved back to El Paso from Dallas.
I'll have to come back and do the Carne Al Pastor, and then we're going to do some ribeyes for the grill, I think, as well.
Thank you for listening to this edition of The Weekend. A big thanks to Sam Cassiano, audio engineer for this program. I'm Angela Cocheriga, and this is KTEP 88.5 FM, your NPR station for the Southwest.
Support for local production of The Weekend on KTEP comes from the estate of Maxie Templeton.